Hello and welcome to the Squawker Talker Euro 2020 Group B Preview Podcast. Red hot favourites Belgium are up against tournament novices Finland, as well as Russia and Euro 1992 winners Denmark. And it's the Danes, the Great Danes, that's where we get ourselves kicked off in this section. I'm joined by chief football writer Michel Davidson at Danish outlet BT. Michel, before we get into the team and the squad and some of the selection dilemmas that are facing relatively new manager Hjulmund, I want to talk about the boss just for a second. He came in after qualification to take over from what was a very experienced setup under Arge Haaland, who'd been in charge for 4 or 5 years. And Hjulmund has essentially taken over the same group of players. There's not been a massive amount of changes, but what's been the public perception of him and the job that he's done so far?
There's a perception that Kasper Hjulmund has taken this team, which was a very strong team, a very defensively strong team, and he made it into a more modern team. I would say that the team has transformed under Hjulmund and has become more of a unit in the offensive part. When we saw the Åge Hareide team, it was also a unit, but it was mostly when defending. So everyone in the team worked hard. But when it came to the offensive part of the team of Hareide, he put all his eggs in one basket, that basket being Christian Eriksen, of course. And Christian Eriksen loved it, and he scored lots of goals under Hareide. He hasn't been quite the same player under Hjulmund. So Hjulmund has made another plan for the offensive part of the game, and that is to let other players contribute to the offensive part of the game. He's had a more detailed plan for the whole team to create chances, to pass the ball. The defensive line is significantly higher, I would say, under Hjulmund, and also the pressure on the ball is a bit more intense.
Looking at qualification, that key win over Switzerland eventually got Denmark over the line. Draws with Ireland kind of complicated things, but it wasn't the most exciting qualification campaign, but it was a difficult group, obviously, with Switzerland and the Republic of Ireland, who were fancy to kind of scrap their way through to the tournament. But Hjulmund has bounced back, 3 consecutive wins in World Cup qualification in the start of 2021. So there is a bit more positivity, ironically, if the tournament had been last summer than it will be now, 12 months further down the line.
Yeah, you're totally right. I would say in Denmark there's this kind of Euro fever, because we actually... when we talk to people and so on, people do believe that this Danish team could take it very far in the Euro. So that wasn't the situation last summer, because even though Hareide, the former coach, had a great team, it was the results oriented team, like when you see Jose Mourinho playing football or something like that. Hjulmund is more in the Pep Guardiola way, playing more possession football, even though he doesn't like to talk about it. So I would say that here in Denmark, people are thinking that we could go very far. There's very much positivity, and that is, of course, because of the 3 last games in the qualification here in 2021. It's been good games, even though some of the teams, of course, hasn't been of a very high quality, some of the opponents. But Denmark has just been more fluent in the game, and they've been good. So there's a good people are happy, people are excited.
And as much as there is a bit more of a feel-good factor and a slightly more attacking style, more possession, looking to get more out of the creative players, that solid base does still exist with plenty of Premier League experience. Kasper Schmeichel, Yannick Vestergaard, and Andreas Christensen at Chelsea has done brilliantly since Thomas Tuchel has come in. There seems to have been a bit of a difficult time for him in the last 12 to 18 months, but Tuchel has really backed him. As soon as he's come in, he's put a lot of faith in him. And obviously, we know that Chelsea have done brilliantly. They're battling to qualify for the Champions League this season. They're through to the Champions League final. Christensen looks set to play a key role for Denmark this season, because we've always known that the raw materials are there for such a talented player. Now we're starting to see what he can do on a regular basis.
Yeah, and in Denmark, we've never doubted him. He's also always been like the greatest defensive talent we've had for a long time. And the funny part about all this is that Andreas Christensen is playing, but he's not playing with Vestergaard, who is kind of prolific player in Southampton. He's not playing with Joachim Andersen. You also know for his good run in Fulham. He's actually playing with Simon Kjær, who is a defender from Milan. So Denmark in the defensive part, in the central defender part, we do have lots of players. But of course, Andreas Christensen playing regularly in Chelsea has also made his game even more slick. He is like a smooth defender. We already knew that. He's not maybe not the fastest defender. He maybe not being the strongest defender, but he might be one of the smartest defenders. So he is a very, very important player for this team. But not more important than the captain, who is Simon Kjær, playing beside him. But this is one place on the field that Denmark we could have one or two injuries and still be very strong. So yeah, the defensive part also with Kasper Schmeichel, as you say, in tremendous form. Yeah, that's one of the things we're also looking at.
And looking at the midfield, obviously Eriksen we'll get to in just a second. We talk about Denmark, we have to talk about Christian Eriksen. But behind him, slightly doing some more of the rough stuff, Pierre Højbjerg and Thomas Delaney at Borussia Dortmund are really, really important, not just to Denmark, but to Christian Eriksen, to allow him that bit more space, that bit more time on the ball. And obviously, it's been a frustrating season for Dortmund. They won the German Cup, but came up short in the Bundesliga. Pierre Højbjerg, it's been a strange season for him at Tottenham. Jose Mourinho brought him to the club. He seemed to be a real favourite of Mourinho. Then, as things started to go a bit sour for Mourinho, Højbjerg was a little bit of a scapegoat. We know that Mourinho is a fan of blaming players when things don't go his way. Ryan Mason's come in on a temporary basis and brought him back into the team. And he seems to be enjoying his football again. And he seems to have that bit of grit back in him that is perfect just in time for the European Championships.
Yeah, Pierre-Emile Højbjerg is like, he's kind of the heart of this team because he's a funny guy. In Denmark, we are a bit, we're not that outgoing and we're not that emotionally, expressive. But Højbjerg is, he's like this, he has this French blood in him and he's half French. And you can see that he's very much, he's like the guy crying when things are not going his way or his team's way. So Højbjerg is the heart of this team, and we've seen him playing. He was actually out of the team. That's a funny story. Under Harreide, he had a bad couple of years where him and Harreide wasn't a good thing. He was not called up for the national team, but he in the last part of Harreide is a national team coach era. He was one of the first guys on the sheet. So Pierre-Emile Højbjerg, his form is of course also a thing we're looking at. But we are Denmark. We're not a nation with world class players everywhere. So we need to have the best 11 ready. We can have an injury or two in the central defense, as I said, but not in the midfield. That wouldn't be good at all. Pierre-Emile Højbjerg is so important for this team, as you say, to cover for Christian Eriksen, also to cover a little bit for Thomas Delaney, who is also a player going into the box when there's an opening. So yeah. Pierre-Emile Højbjerg, he is. We hope he's finding his best form just now.
Someone that is world class. You touched on that. Maybe there's not world class players right the way through the squad, but someone that is that falls definitely into that bracket is Christian Eriksen, and he comes into this tournament in an odd situation. Inter Milan have won Serie A first time since 2010, but based on his stats, based on his amount of appearances for them this season, he's not been an absolute first pick for Antonio Conte. 17 league starts and 8 substitute appearances. He's played his part, and given the fact that when you're gunning for a title, you need a squad of players, not just 11. But he will be disappointed not to have had a more central role. But based on time and time again, his performances for Denmark, whether or not he's performing for his club side doesn't seem to matter. In the past, when there was issues at Tottenham and maybe he wasn't playing as much, when he turned up for Denmark, he turned up.
Totally right. And there are many sides of the Christian Eriksen story, because his situation is not as bad now as it was a couple of months ago, because in the run-in for the championship in Italy, he was actually playing a lot. So we actually in another place now than we were a couple of months back, and we are very happy that he fought his way through to the starting 11 under Conte. We were in January, we thought, well, he has to go. He cannot stay there because he's not playing, and that's not good for Denmark. We need Christian Eriksen as one of our best players. But that's also another part of the story. It is that Kasper Juhlmann has made another plan for the Danish team. So it's not as designed to make Christian Eriksen better as it was under Harreide. And now there are more players contributing to making creating the chances, to scoring the goals and so on. So right now, even though we're talking about the Danish team being in a good state of mind and playing well, it's even without Christian Eriksen playing to his full potential. That's a funny thing, because he hasn't been at his best for the Danish national teams in 2021. Actually, he has not found the space as he did under Harreide, and that's because Harreide totally designed his team to make space for Christian Eriksen. And every time Denmark had the ball, just played to Eriksen. See what happens. It was not the most complex plan, but it was a plan that worked. Now there are more players that Juhlmann are looking to, and there are more passes in the team. So it's a funny story about Eriksen, but we do need him, because, as you say, he is one of the only world class players, and Christian Eriksen in the top of his form and playing for Denmark, that is something we need to go for.
And looking slightly further up the team in attack, as you say, there are options. It doesn't have to be Eriksen or nothing. Martin Brathwaite, Yusuf Poulsen, Kasper Dahlberg are all coming in to this perfectly capable of staking a claim in the starting 11. Is there maybe even an argument that there's too many options for Hjulmand, that he's going to have to strike a balance to get all these players in the team while still ensuring that it's a tactically solid plan, that he's not just throwing names into the starting 11?
Yeah, I think that he actually found his starting 11 in these past couple of months in the last games, because he actually took out Kasper Dahlberg, who he was actually really, really trying to get to work in the Danish national team. Kasper Dahlberg hasn't been working well in the Danish national team. And he tried, but when Kasper Dahlberg played, you saw Brathwaite, you saw Yusuf Poulsen not playing to their best. So now he put in Jonas Wind, actually a young player from the Danish team, FC Copenhagen. And Jonas Wind has been playing very good, and he's a player that has been he's been doing so well, because when he plays, then Yusuf Poulsen and Martin Brathwaite, they are playing better, because Jonas Wind are a player, a striker, going down and taking the ball and distributing it from even though he's an attacker. And then you have these two players, Poulsen and Brathwaite, who are so fast, and they can do something else. So right now, I think that I couldn't mention the six players in the offensive part, if you would say that, the three midfielders, the three attackers. I'm not even, there's no doubt in me that who they are. It's pretty sure. And actually, I would say around 10 of the 11 places in the starting 11, they're already given.
Obviously, Vind, as you mentioned, has broken through and looked impressive. He's got three goals in the last 12 months. That's a record match by Andres Skov Olsen as well, who's got three goals in 12 months as well. So these are two young, exciting attacking options that, as you say, if it's not working or Hjulmand wants to change it or try something different, Skov Olsen and Vind, who you've mentioned, are options. And Olsen offers something different. He's quick. He's able to make runs in behind. And he's a real goal-scoring threat. When you look at Brathwaite, we've seen him at Barcelona. He's very good at linking the play and bringing other players into it. He's very selfless. But Olsen is someone that, if he gets space in behind and gets chances, he will score goals.
Yeah, and Scott Olsen is also a player who can do something with the ball himself. He doesn't need to be he doesn't need to link up with other players. He can take the ball. He can dribble. He can just go past his opponent and then score. We already knew him from when he was playing in FC Nordsjælland here in the Superliga here in Denmark, where his signature move was like you know from Arjen Robben, cutting inside and just firing with his left foot. That is fierce. He got skill. He's not so powerful, but he's still a big guy, and he's got some speed He's just another kind of player, because you know that Yusuf Poulsen, he's a powerful player to have on one side, and you know Brathwaite, he's a fast player linking up, as you say, good with his teammates, very selfless. And then you have, if these two players are not working, he just knows, I can put in Scott Olsen and he can do something on his own. So that's a good plan B, I would say, very good plan B.
And in terms of progress from the group, one thing that Denmark will have to avoid is losing that first game. 2016 was the first time Denmark managed to avoid defeat on the opening day. And given the fact that Belgium are so well fancied to power out of the group and potentially go all the way and win this, it is more than likely to be a scrap for second place with Russia and Finland. But Denmark have more experience, obviously, than Finland in major tournaments. And Russia, the 2018 World Cup was massively helpful to them being the home advantage that they had. There's a real chance for Denmark here to kind of operate kind of in Belgium's shadow, get on with their own job, get themselves out of the group. And I actually think the way that the tournament pans out, there's a chance for them to go quite far, potentially even the semi-finals.
Yeah, I think so too, and you're right. If Denmark should even dream about the semifinal, as I do too, then the first game is crucial, because it's against Finland. And as you say, Denmark hasn't been good in the first game at these Euros. So what we need is, of course, you need the second place to take the good way to the semifinal. I say as you, I think Denmark has I would be disappointed if Denmark didn't go through to the round of 16. That's, they just have to. Also, when you're looking at the best third place teams, Denmark has to be one of the best placed best third place team. So that's a given for me. With the form of this team and the opponents, of course, as you say, Belgium, one of the favorites for the whole Euro. That's going to be kind of impossible. Denmark played Belgium a couple of times, and we don't stand a chance against these world class players. But Russia and Finland, we have to do something against them. And then from there on, it looks like it could be, if we say that Denmark is going to be runner up, it could be then we could play against Switzerland, Turkey, or Wales, and that's three nations that I would say Denmark can beat. Not every single time, but I would say that there's a good chance against them. And then you get to the quarterfinals, and it looks like it's gonna be Holland, the Netherlands. I know I'm already way far, but I could see it's not impossible for Denmark to go through to the semifinals. I wouldn't be surprised.
Cautious optimism, Michel. I love it. Yeah. Thanks so much for your time discussing Denmark's chances at Euro 2020.
You're welcome.
Great stuff. And up next, it is the Belgians. We're talking to Belgian journalist Christophe Thieu. He's going to be previewing the golden generation of Roberto Martinez. We'll catch you in just a second. Hello and welcome back to the Euro 2020 Squawker Talker Preview Podcast. Group B and Finland. Fantastic story that Finland are finally through to their first ever major championship. It's been years and years of hurt for Finland football fans, but despite having to wait an extra 12 months, they are finally here. Big, big summer ahead for Finland and for football fans in the country. I'm joined by Finnish football journalist Antti Salo to preview the team and look ahead to their chances this summer. But just qualification for a major tournament is a huge, huge thing for Finland. It's been years and years of near misses and frustration. But that night when qualification was clinched, there must have been a hell of a party in Finland.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. And it was a November night, 2019, with the victory against Liechtenstein to secure the spot in the Euros. And the streets of Helsinki were flooded with happy and maybe somewhat drunk football fans climbing into fountains, taking their clothes off, partying like it's the biggest achievement of a lifetime, which it actually was. It's been 80 years of trying to reach for the major tournament. So football fans in Finland really, really made a meal out of it. And I remember as a kid, you always wait for the summer vacation, and the best part is the wait, actually. And then when it finally comes, and it's over. So now we had a chance of waiting 12 more months. So the appetite is even bigger at the moment, actually.
And as you say, the 12-month delay due to the COVID-19 pandemic, it hasn't changed the enthusiasm that Finland fans will have for this tournament. When you've waited so long and had so much frustration, it doesn't matter. I'm not going to say you'd wait another 12 months, but given the fact that the fans are such a passionate group and that the connection between the team and the fans and the country is very, very special. We saw with Iceland in Euro 2016 and their first European Championships, just this incredible force of the fans pulling the team on. Are you confident that despite the fact there's not going to be Finnish fans in stadiums this summer, that back home the message will be so strong in behind the team?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Luckily, there will be, of course, some fans attending, the lucky ones, who made the second cut, but that's like some thousands, I think. But they will make definitely make a noise and cheer for the team. The main thing is actually that the games are going to go ahead. It was kind of like a Finnish football folklore that after all these years, when we finally qualify for the major tournament, and then the games are cancelled, so it was kind of bittersweet the first time. First time, can this really happen? Now we are in the Euros, so now they are cancelling the Euros. But luckily, they just moved the Euros for 1 year forward, so everybody can attend and watch the television. And as you mentioned about the Finland players and supporters and the relationship, I think that's something that's really special with this Finland team and the supporters. Like it has always been good, nothing to do with winning, because it's not about winning when you're supporting a Finland national team. It's more than often the qualifications had ended in a disappointment, but always the players and fans have been cheering to each other. But maybe in recent years, with the goalkeeper Lukas Radetzky at the front of the players, they've been celebrating more in front of the fans. Radetzky even drinking a beer from one of the supporters' pints after one match in the curve. So it's really, really close, and I think it's really special. Special the relationship with the players and the fans. So in that case, everybody's really, really looking forward to the games.
Obviously, main man Timo Pukki, we will get to him. He's obviously central to what Finland are going to do this summer. His record in qualification is fantastic, and he is the main man. But before we get on to Pukki and what to expect from him, defensively, starting from the back, this has been a project that has really been founded in strong defensive principles. Just looking at the record from qualification, a one goal per game ratio of conceding is relatively solid, particularly when you've got Italy in that group. And then moving into the Nations League, 5 wins, 4 clean sheets. And generally speaking, even if Finland do lose or do draw, they do not concede many goals. It's very rare to see them shipping a lot of goals. And that will give confidence ahead of this tournament.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's actually one of the biggest topics in Finland at the moment is the whether the coach Marko Kanerva will go through with the 5-3-2 with five on the back or three center backs and two wing backs, because he started with the 4-4-2 and got really, really good results. But then the coaching staff and Kanerva kind of figured that against the stronger teams, they need 5-3-2 formation, not just in the back line, but to close the midfield more and close the pockets more. So at the beginning, they didn't get really good results and it got a lot of criticism, but they've been pushing and training the formation more and more. And now I guess they are getting better results. But the question is really, can Finland find two world-class wing backs? I think that's the problem with that formation. We have good center backs and good fullbacks, but the wing back is so difficult position and requires so much for attacking and also defending. So I think that's the Achilles heel at the moment. And Kanerva and his coaching staff will need to figure out if that is actually the way forward. But as you mentioned, the defense has been key to Finland and giving Finland chance to win, because they don't concede goals and they are always good positioned in the penalty box and really blocking shots. And it sometimes it might seem like it's chaotic, but it's actually good, very, very well organized, and the players are where they're supposed to be and blocking shots, and Radetzky at the goal just keeping the other shots away. So the defense is really, really the key, but it's the whole team that defends, of course.
Okay, Pukki time. If the Pukki party continues, Finland have got a big chance, and his record at national team level is fantastic in the last couple of years. In European Championship qualifying, only Cristiano Ronaldo and Harry Kane scored more than him. 10 goals in 10 games to get Finland to Euro 2020. He's picked that up in qualification for the World Cup. Some really important goals in the first three games of 2021. Given the fact that he's coming into this full of confidence, Norwich are promoted, another excellent season in front of goal for them to get them back into the Premier League, 26 goals in 41 games. There's no danger of him being tired. There's a potential concern over an injury, but we do expect him to be included in the squad. Other players, you would look at this and think, 40 plus games, he could be tired. But when he comes to Finland, when he pulls on that shirt, he is Superman.
He actually mentioned in one of the interviews a few years ago that his biggest dream is achieving a place in the final tournament with the Finnish national football team. And now he has done it. And I don't think that anything will keep him away from the Euros. He's definitely in the squad. At the moment, everybody's thinking like it's a good thing that he has this little knock on his ankle, so he will be fresh for the Euros. And what I hear is that he picked up the injury during the game at the early stages of the game, and he still played almost 80 minutes or something like that. So it can't be really bad injury. So that also gives indication that he's going to be fit, and he's monumental player for Finland, and you can see it from the statistics. 1-0 victories, 2-0 victories, he's always there to score the important goal, and the defense gives that chance for him to make a difference between the sides, and he has done it in so many games, and it would be a catastrophe if for some reason he wouldn't be able to play or gets injured during the games. That's also a possibility, of course.
When we look at his record in qualification, people will say he plays for Norwich in the Championship. When he played in the Premier League, he had a very good start to the season, and then with Norwich's issues beginning to kick in, things tailed off and they were relegated. And it is very easy to dismiss him in terms of his ability to do it at the highest level. But when you look at his performances for Finland, getting the goals against Italy, getting goals in World Cup qualification, he's not frightened of performing on that big stage. And as you say, it's a lifelong ambition to play in a major tournament for Finland. He'll need no more motivation to go out and be the hero.
No. Actually, we have a I work at a TV station, and we had a pundit, Jussi Jääskeläinen, former Premier League goalkeeper, several hundreds of games. And he mentioned that when a player scores plus 10 goals in Premier League, he really can make it at the highest level. So with 11 goals in Premier League last season, I think Pukki has proved that he can make it at the big stage. He for some reason didn't score at the final half of the season, but the goals he scored in the European qualifiers and he has already scored now with the World Cup qualifiers, I think speaks for themselves that he is capable of performing at the big stage, and I believe that he is waiting eagerly to prove his worth at the Euros this summer.
Obviously, there's massive attention on Pukki and the goals that he'll hopefully bring to Finland, but it would be unfair to say that it's all about him in an attacking sense. Fredrik Jensen, he's enjoyed a very, very positive 12 months, 5 goals in his last 5 starts, and he's expected to maybe play just in behind Pukki this summer. Can you expect something from him? He has looked impressive, back-to-back goals against Ireland in the Nations League, and he seems to be the type of player that if a chance falls his way, he'll stick it in the back of the net.
Yeah, he was kind of like sneaking from the behind. And he's always been a talent in Finland, but I think never really like blossomed in a way that some of the attackers like Pukki did. But he was really good in Nations League and providing the goals when Pukki had a try spell. So he's definitely like a joker card or wild card in Finland squad. And when you play in Bundesliga with Augsburg, you have to have some quality, and he has also had some injuries, but now he's fit and I think he's a really good wild card for Finland in the attack.
And there's a few other names that jump off the page in terms of, again, this idea of taking some of that pressure off Pukki to score the goals. Oni Valikari, son of former Finland international Simo Valikari, is someone that's stepped up. He's been in fantastic form for his club side, Paphos, in Cyprus this year. 13 goals from midfield. And Brentford striker Marcus Force, we know that Brentford are pushing to join Norwich in the Premier League next season. He's fairly new on the international scene, but the signs look positive at Brentford and for Finland.
Yeah, exactly. And the two young players that you mentioned, Onni Valakari and Marcus Force, actually they are the two players that gained most for the games Euro 2020 being pushed for 1 year, because last summer neither of them would have a chance to be in the Finland squad. Now, the next fall, last fall against France, defending world champion, Marcus Force scored the first goal and Onni Valakari scored the second goal. Finland wins 2-0 away at the defending world champion. So I think they both have to be in the squad and really young, interesting talent. But I think the main man behind Pukki is Joel Pohjanpalo, Bundesliga striker, now plays for Union Berlin on loan from Leverkusen, and just had a hat-trick in late April against Werder Bremen. So I think he's the one that really takes the pressure off from Pukki, and the two know each other actually pretty well. They've been playing in club level together in Finland and are close friends, and they have a really good relationship on and off the pitch. Pohjanpalo providing and Pukki running deep behind the lines. So I think that's also interesting pairing. And Pohjanpalo also had some injuries, but is now fit and happy to chase the number one striker spot from Pukki even, but I think Pukki is the number one, Pohjanpalo then the second, and very, very capable of scoring if Pukki for some reason has a try spell.
And looking at the group and in terms of qualification, Belgium are red-hot favourites to go on and win the competition as a whole. So Denmark and Russia are likely to be the two that are going to battle Finland for second place or potentially a best third-place spot. Given the fact that Russia, home advantage was a big factor for them in 2018, there's not a lot of confidence surrounding them going into this tournament. Denmark, generally speaking, you know what you're going to get with Denmark. They are very experienced. With Christian Eriksen popped into that team, they've got a world-class talent that can turn a game. But Finland have maybe not necessarily a world-class talent, but an important talent in Timo Pukki. So given the way the group has panned out, there is the opportunity for Finland to do an Iceland, get out of the group and make their mark on the competition.
Definitely. And the way I see it, and I think the way the Finnish fans and the people in Finland see it is that we definitely have a chance of qualifying either in the top two or as you mentioned, best third one. Stephen Kenny, the Ireland manager, mentioned in his press conference when they played against Finland that Finland is like a club team in a way that they are organized, very well organized. It feels like you are playing against a club team. And when you're that well organized and you have a man like Pukki up front who can provide you with the winning goals, that's the key to success. And I really feel that we have a genuine chance of drawing against Russia, Denmark, and maybe if we can clinch that victory against one of them. As you mentioned, Belgium might be too tough as they are the favorites for the whole tournament, but the draw against Denmark and win against Russia or the other way around, I think there might be a chance. I don't know how the mathematics go. Do you have a chance with 3 points to be the one of the best third placed teams? I haven't made that mathematics yet, but definitely the big goal is to go through the group stage.
Fantastic stuff. Positive signs for Pukki and for Finland. I think we'd all love to see another tournament debutant bomb on and get into the knockout stages. Antti, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks.
Great stuff. And up next, we're going to be previewing Russia as the final team in Group B. We'll catch you in just a second. Hello and welcome back to the Euro 2020 Group B preview. And up next is the world's number one, the best team in qualifying, the golden generation of Belgium. And I'm joined by Belgian football journalist Christophe Terreur to preview them ahead of the tournament. Now, anybody knows that going into a tournament with a favourites tag or a golden generation or any of these things, it can weigh heavy on a player, on a manager, and on a fan base. So Belgium are going into this tournament with a lot of pressure and a lot of expectation based on the players that they have and how fantastic they've been in qualification. Christophe, what is the mood from a Belgian fan point of view surrounding the team at the minute? They know they have all these fantastic players. Is there a confidence that they can finally get it together at a major tournament?
Well, basically, it's a last chance, I think. I think last year, before the tournament got cancelled, of course, I thought, well, yeah, this is the now or never moment. We still have Vincent Kompany at the back in his last year as a player. We still have the whole group together. And now there's still, yeah, it's still early days, of course. We're still like a month before the tournament. So the hype that there was before the previous tournaments, I haven't felt yet. Also because we have some injuries in our squad, but once we get rolling, I think the hype might get back during the group stages. But it's not that we are. I think World Cup 2018 was really our moment because then the generation were all in their prime. Now we have some older players, but still Italy did it with an old squad. So maybe we'll do it with an old squad too, because I think average age-wise, we will be one of the older squads at the tournament. So yeah, but we can't deny that we're favourites, although Belgians like to push themselves in the underdog role always, because we like it, just Belgian fans and Belgian people, while those players still think that they can win the tournament. They are confident. Because they play at the highest level, they don't have that underdog feeling anymore.
And obviously, we'll look at the team and some of the selection questions that Martinez is going to face in the next few weeks in a second, but pressure and experience in these situations is always so vital in a major tournament. And Belgium do have this reputation. You look back at a World Cup or European Championships, 2014, 2016, and then 2018, there is still this nearly man t- tag that's attached themselves to it of a quarterfinal or a semi-final. But when it really, really comes to the crunch of reaching the final and going on and getting their hands on a trophy, they just seem to fall short. Based on the qualification, as I say, 10 wins out of 10, no defeat in 2 years. Just one defeat in 2 years against England. There must be an expectation growing now that that step has finally been taken.
Yeah, and we've been making progress. If you look at the, if you look back at the past, like Brazil was a quarter final. Yeah, at Euro, we forget Euro 2016 because that was a disaster when we lost to Wales. We got to the semi-finals into the World Cup, and now because some of our best players have experienced now like the same kind of pressure in Champions League semi-finals, I find it very important that Kevin De Bruyne, that he qualified for Champions League final, for instance, because then you get that feeling like that are the ultimate knockouts. Yeah, I'm not going to call it tryouts because it's at the same level as a World Cup of Euro, but there you build up that experience. Belgium have built up some experience during the World Cups too. They have been in the semi-final. Now they know how it feels to play against a team like France back then in 2018, who were just defending and having a good game plan and neutralizing everything, all our qualities. Now they've coped with that. They know how it feels. They know how to lose a semi-final too. Until last year, when you could still meet players, sometimes that semi-final and got mentioned again, like players were saying, we still have to take revenge for that lost semi-final. We still have that in our minds. That's one of the biggest disappointments in our career at national team level. So I think they will take that into this tournament too, that experience of France, how to cope with those kind of games. And we have that experience. We're now one of the most experienced teams too. And we've been in semi-finals. We've played a third place knockout round. That doesn't matter anymore. But we have now the experience. And we can't say this team is young anymore. This golden generation lacks the experience at all levels. All our players have now won trophies in every single league. Romelu Lukaku was the only one with the blank behind his name. Was the first 11 players who hadn't won a trophy. He led Inter, I'm not going to say himself to the title, but he was very important. And all of our players now have been important. They know what a feeling is, so they will now take that experience to the national team. Plus, what has changed over the last 2 years in the Belgian national team is that a smart move of Roberto Martinez, he's put his players into a training course, so they're all following UEFA badges. All the guys that are interested, some already dropped out of the lessons or pulled out of the lessons, but you still have guys who learn to think as a manager now. For instance, a 24-year-old like Yuri Tielemans, he talks with lots of enthusiasm about training batches and courses and tacticals. And that's smart by Martinez because managers can't always solve things on the pitch. That he makes those players aware of tactical things, that they can change things themselves on the pitch. So that's an extra experience that they have, that they learn to think tactically, and that is preparing some of those guys to become a manager, and that helps a manager too, because last tournaments we still had Thierry Henry on board, like a serial winner who could tell the players about pressure and what it is to deal with big tournaments. We don't have him on board anymore, but Martinez has found another way to push them to that extra level. And I think that might help them too in solving tactical situations themselves too, because all of those players, they have worked on a high level. Like Kevin De Bruyne has now worked his fifth season under Pep Guardiola. That's the university of football, basically. You have Thibaut Courtois, who's worked with Conte, with Mourinho, with Zidane, with Simeone, Eden Hazard, basically almost the same. Toby Alderweireld, Jan Vertonghen, they've worked with Pochettino. So they have Divo Origi, although I don't think he will be in the squad, Simon Mignolet, they've worked with Jurgen Klopp. So if you add all the experience of the high-level training sessions that they've had and all the situations they've been in, Martinez has now challenged them to bring that experience that you have at the team level, bring that to tactical sessions, bring that to your head to think about things. And yeah, maybe that might help us too.
When you look at the squad and the players that are available to Martinez, it's absolutely dripping with talent and with experience right the way through the team. You look at the defensive unit of Courtois, Bertongen and Alderweireld, 316 international caps between them. But even in a squad of stars or a team of stars, Kevin De Bruyne is so good and so influential to Belgium and obviously to Manchester City. The way that Pep Guardiola has reshuffled the Manchester City team to get the best from De Bruyne in the most prolific areas of the pitch to ensure that he's providing assists, that he's scoring goals. And as you say, leading that Manchester City team to the Champions League final has broken another career barrier for him. How important is he going to be in this Belgium team? We talk about player after player that is a world-class individual, but De Bruyne still stands a head and shoulders above.
Yeah, he will be the connection between defense and attack. He will be our main provider. Like, we still will need somebody else, the one who's been missing for the last 2 years, Eden Hazard. We can deal without Hazard, but I don't think we can deal without him in the big games, because De Bruyne is at his best when he's playing in that number eight role, where he's basically 8.5, who has been playing at Manchester City till he became a false nine, of course. So if De Bruyne is playing as an attacking midfielder closer to Lukaku, you still miss some of the impulses he gives to the team when he's in midfield. He dictates the rhythm of the Belgian team, basically. And when he plays closer to the striker, to Lukaku, you miss some of those good passes. He sees things that other players don't see, and nobody will in the current Belgian squad will probably ever reach the level of the vision he has of seeing passes. And so that's why he's definitely against teams that play with 10 at the back, those who park the bus, basically. Then you need Kevin De Bruyne to pick the right passes and to dictate the rhythm. And he's going to be so important in that eight role. So everybody's hoping that Eden Hazard will be in a good shape, so we'll get the best out of Kevin De Bruyne too. Because Hazard has that acceleration, that one dribble, that one action that can change a whole game or suck defenders towards him. So Lukaku has more space. So I think that if we want to become European champion, we will need a good Eden Hazard too. I don't think we will see the best Eden Hazard at the Euros. Maybe I'm wrong, but we'll need both of them. Basically, all three of them, Lukaku, Hazard and De Bruyne, they will be so important. And the rest of the team, if your midfield is good, our defense is getting old and slow. If Alderweireld turned 32, I think, and Vertonghen's 34, Thomas Vermaelen is turns 36. So all defense need to be protected too. And there, for the manager, his main man is missing. That's Axel Witsel, who is at the She'll stand an injury. We're not sure if he will make, will be fit in time. I don't think he will be fit for the group stage, but as teams get now the chance to pick 26 players, he might be still in the squad. And if we play the final, he might be fit for the final. And if there's a chance he will get fit for a final, Martinez will always take him in the squad, because he's there for the balance. He plays simple passes. He covers a lot of ground. He recovers lots of balls. So that's the ultimate balance player in a team that everybody says always playing slow and he's always playing sideways. But those players are very important for structure. It means that De Bruyne can make his run. De Bruyne doesn't have to look back. Oh, what's happening in my back now? And if we have to play Tielemans and De Bruyne, who are both at their best in an eight role, basically, we'll miss a little bit of balance because they're not the most accomplished in recovering balls and bringing that natural rest that Witsel is giving to a team. So I think Roberto Martinez is praying that everything will be fine with Witsel till we get into the stages that matter, that is the second round, because everybody thinks we will survive those group stages easily, which probably won't be the case.
And whilst there might be potentially concerns over Eden Hazard and how he's going to come into the squad on the back of a difficult season with Real Madrid, there's no such concerns over Lukaku. He's been absolutely magnificent for Inter Milan this season, 21 league goals at the time of recording. But perhaps even more impressive, he's got 28 goals in his last 26 games for Belgium, just to completely underline what a brilliant player he is. And based on the season that he's had with Inter Milan, coming into the European Championships this summer, the stage looks set for him to finally tick that box of saying, I am as good as any other number nine in world football, and here I am.
Yeah, and he's scoring for fun. And what the change we've seen during those last 3 years, if you look at where he was in 2018, where he already scored some goals, and if you look at him now, Antonio Conte has added three dimensions to his game. He's now great with his back to the goal. He's great with his face to the goal. He scores easily. He's added like clever movements to him. He's running. It's really good. He even creates chances. Now we can't forget those 10 assists. Even the assist king in the Serie A, if you look at that, which is strange for a striker. But he's become. It's not Robert Lewandowski yet, because that's another level. But I think he feels now, after what he's done this season, that he can achieve those levels. He always says if Ronaldo and Messi and Lewandowski can keep on improving every year, I can improve too. If everybody has had that mentality in the Belgian squad, I think we'll already have won something, because Lukaku is a real winner and is working every day to become a better player. You can't change humans, of course. You never can change humans and their characters. But I think Conte has triggered something extra. He's now the ultimate siege mentality, I think. I hope he takes some things of Conte, of what he's learned, into this Belgian squad too. And before, he already was a leader in the dressing room. Like, he was talking a lot. He was doing those huddles before a game, when he was talking and encouraging the players. Now he has a right to say something, because he's finally won a trophy, because we all know how it goes in the dressing room. Oh, he's shouting hard. He's screaming at me, but he's never won something. Who is he? That's the way that some players react to players who have not won anything. And now he's won something, and I think that has added something extra to his game. And stages for him now, he's at the prime of his career, 20 years old. I think he really wants to shine. And he has that big advantage that Inter were already champions in the beginning of May. So he can not only mentally prepare for the tournament, also physically, he won't be pushed to the limit anymore. So he has like those 6 weeks of extra rest, which might help him. He's not like De Bruyne, who still needs to push for the Champions League final. He's not like some of the English star who are still fighting for trophies. I'm not sure if they're going to win the championship or not. So they have to compete those 90 minutes all the time. He can back off a little bit and do it a little bit slower and get into the right physical and mental state of mind before a tournament.
And obviously, established name after established name, De Bruyne, Lukaku, Hazard, Courtois, they do just rack up for Belgium and for Martinez. But somebody that's kind of come up through the ranks and might be a little bit off the radar is Rennes star Jeremy Doku, who's been excellent for them this season in Ligue 1. And obviously, with Rennes, there's a lot of focus on Eduardo Camavinga, who we expect to be named in the France squad. But Doku is somebody that, if the situation requires, he can be used as an impact sub, or could potentially be used in a game where they need someone a bit quicker on the ball, who moves the ball between the lines better than other players. Can he add something to a team that's absolutely already packed with superstars?
Everybody was away laughing when he was selected for Belgium, because he had proven himself at Anderlecht, but he wasn't really consistent enough. But he's now made that step to the Ligue 1. Everybody was surprised that Rennes paid so much money for him, to be fair, in Belgium. But he's proving that all the scouts at he was on Liverpool's radar when he was 16 year old. They saw something similar to the unpredictability that, for instance, Sadio Mane has in his game too. They had seen that pace, those dribbles. Roberto Martinez had noticed the same. Look at the positive qualities, not at the things he doesn't have right now. Look at that pace and that dribble. That's something he'd been showing at the Rem too. He had a difficult start of the season, but what he has and what his previous managers all mention is that he's very brave. If he loses the ball, he will keep on trying. He will keep on trying. And in the end, he will make it. And that one final moment in a game where he can dribble a guy or make that one good final pass, that can be enough. And there's always the threat of the pace. And definitely when Belgium are playing against a little more open side, you can use that pace on the counter-attack, but you can also use him to unlock the door when you're playing against a team that's playing with 10 men behind the balls, park the bus. He will keep on running at that defender, keep on running until he gets that one chance, and then you'll have to take it, and then he will pass it to another player. But he keeps on trying, and that's an important thing, trying to dribble past another player. And that's something that coaches always point out. That guy isn't mentally distracted after he has failed something. He keeps on trying. It's a good quality for a player, and that's why he has improved too. He suddenly, when he scored his first goal for Rennes, it was in March, the second game, and you saw him growing. So that's purely confidence thing too. I think that we're not gonna heap all the pressure on him because he's still 18 years old. At the age of 18, I saw Kevin De Bruyne playing for Genk. Didn't know he would become that world star that he is now. But Doku has something, like Roberto Martinez always says, something special in his game, and that's that one acceleration, that one dribble that can make a difference. And he has to become more consistent, of course. He has to score more goals. He has to give more assists. But that comes with age. That always comes with age. The young Kevin De Bruyne only gave 5 assists in a season in his first season. So you can't expect that from a guy. But he can add something extra that we don't have in our squad right now, is that freshness and that one blistering pace that the older guys don't have anymore.
So crunch time. Any Belgian fan knows if there's one team that they have a terrible record against, 4 times they've been knocked out against. But if they are going to go to the final and if they're going to win, there's one team that they're going to have to end that record against, and that's France. At some stage in this competition, you would assume that Belgium will come up against France, whether it's semi-final or potentially the final. How confident are you that Belgium now have the skills to break that record against France, and how do you think the tournament is going to end up for Belgium?
Well, I think if all goes well and we win all our games, then we will meet France semi-finals, I guess. So then it's and France win all their games too. Then it's then we will meet them in the semi-finals, I guess. I think it still will be a difficult one, because I think that France have the only manager that has really proven themselves at club level. Didier Deschamps got into the Champions League final once. He worked at a top level, and I think that's something that Roberto Martinez has, of course, worked at. He's won an FA Cup with Wigan. He's done one brilliant season at Everton. But I think that's still maybe lacking. That's the tactical cleverness of Deschamps, who has worked at the highest level in Italy, in France. I think that might still make a difference. I think mentally we will be better prepared for that game because we've been there. But if you look at that, if I look at that France squad, I say, yeah, they have, unless Mbappé is not in the form of his life, Pogba is struggling, the Kante, but if Mbappe is struggling, they still have Giroud. I think that if you look at the whole squad of the France national team, that they have a better squad. Even if I look at the Portuguese squad just on paper, and I look at João Cancelo, best wing back in the Premier League, Ruben Dias, best central defender in the Premier League. If I look at Bruno Fernandes, most efficient midfielder in the Premier League, Bernardo Silva, outstanding player for Manchester City, and Ronaldo still top scorer in the Serie A, André Gomes doing really well in Germany, then Portugal is a tough opponent too. England will be a tough opponent too. So, yes, I'm not 100% confident. I think at the stage, if you looked at all the opponents, the World Cup in 2018 was a better chance for us to win it than this tournament, because all those teams have made steps. England have made steps too. They are younger. They were young in 2018. Now, 3 years later, they have more experience, and they have added Phil Foden to the squad and other exciting players. So I'm not going to say we're going to win it. We must win it. It's our last chance. But I'm not going to say we're the overall favorites. If I look at the progress that some of our opponents have made, Portugal weren't as strong 3 years ago at the World Cup. France is basically an all different team already. Just in 3 years, everything has changed. And maybe I think our flaws in our game will be more recognizable in against those top teams, because then you will see that, for instance, our defense, they got slow. Really, you can't get... The defenders always say 1 year doesn't make a difference, but if you would see, for instance, Mbappe up against Alderweireld, Vertonghen and Vermaelen at this point, I think they won't be on the picture anymore once he accelerates if he gets a lot of space. So that's our main issue, and that's why Witsel is so important. We need somebody good to protect them. We don't have a replacement for Witsel. We don't have N'Golo Kante, the man with 28 legs to prevent the dangers. So that's something that France have in their game too. So yeah, we have a good squad, but I still see all the qualities with our opponents. Maybe I'm talking down Belgium now so we can surprise. Maybe it's just that, pushing ourselves in the underdog role again.
So it sounds like you're building Belgium up to probably continue the nearly man target, but whichever way it goes, it's going to be a fantastic tournament. Lots of pressure on Belgium, but with a huge amount of talent, they are sure to be one of the best sides. Christoph, thanks very much. After you're the welcome. Break, we are going to be previewing Russia with Michael Jokin. We'll catch you then. Hello and welcome back to this Group B preview. And completing Group B, we have Russia. The 2018 World Cup was kind to the home nation, and Euro 2020 takes itself back to St. Petersburg. We have two group games for Russia, and I'm joined by Michael Jokin, international football journalist. Given the situation surrounding the 2018 World Cup with Russia, Michael, supporters were incredibly positive about the team. There was a real feel-good factor about Russia. They reached the knockout stages, and there seemed to be a lot of positivity surrounding the team. There is going to be two group games in St. Petersburg for Euro 2020. Does that positivity still remain surrounding the Russia team and supporters' perceptions of the players?
Well, actually, I think that the tournament was postponed by a year. This fact plays against Russia, because all those that positivity has started to gradually disappear. We are 3 years after the World Cup already, and fans become more and more realistic. And the reality is that Russia is a very average team, to put it mildly. You have to remember that fans were extremely negative as far as the national team was concerned before the World Cup. They expected them to lose to Egypt and to Saudi Arabia, and they thought that it was the worst team in the whole tournament. The fact that they reached the quarterfinals and even managed to throw out Spain in the last 16, it got the nation going behind the team. The team was suddenly seen as a very, very positive unit. There was a lot of positivity. Artem Dzyuba, who was seen as an idiot, suddenly became a hero of the entire nation. He also later became the national team captain. A lot of players literally grew from zeros to heroes during that World Cup. And obviously that good feel... It could be sustained for a while, but not for 3 years. And after 3 years, the Russian fans are becoming negative again. They see that the results are not very good. The players do not perform as expected, and look like the 5-0 defeat in Serbia in the Nations League last year, stuff like that. I don't think fans are very positive about Russia's chances during this tournament, but the first two games, only the first two games take place in St. Petersburg against Belgium and against Finland. If, for example, Russia take 4 points from those games, then sky is the limit. Suddenly they will be the nation's darlings again, and it all depends on the those first two games, whether they manage to show the same togetherness, the same spirit as in 2018, because the spirit, the team spirit is what did it then. And if the spirit is good again, well, then Russia could benefit from this, let's call it a semi-home advantage.
And obviously when you talk about team spirits, experience normally plays a significant part in that, in ensuring that some of the younger players or less experienced players can perform. And there is still plenty of experience within this Russia squad, but there are certain key figures that are not in it anymore. Igor Akinfeev, Sergei Ignashevich have both retired from international football. And from the outside looking in, they're two big names that when you think of the Russian national team, you think of them being associated with it. How has the team and the manager responded to losing some of their most experienced players?
Well, actually, they lost a few experienced players even before the World Cup. The Berezovsky brothers, who were together with Ignashevich and Akinfeev, were the Russian defense for more than a decade. Ignashevich and the Berezovsky brothers retired from the national team before the World Cup. Then Ignashevich was invited. He actually changed his mind at the very, very last second and agreed to take part. And then he retired from football completely. If you are interested, Ignashevich has already taken his place as a Torpedo Moscow coach after retiring, and he was fired a month ago. So he is now a coach who has been fired and not an active player anymore. Akinfeev, of course, is still playing for CSKA Moscow, and Akinfeev was let's say the only true world-class player in this team. He really is a world-class goalkeeper, and he played a crucial part during the World Cup, especially in the penalty shootout against Spain in the last 16, but not only then. Throughout the World Cup, he was just brilliant. And Russia failed to replace him because there are no more world-class goalkeepers in Russia. There was only one. There still is only one. And they didn't really find a decent goalkeeper to replace Akinfeev. As for Ignashevich, they still haven't found a decent center backs either to replace the Berezovsky brothers and Ignashevich in the middle of defense. But in Gikia, they do have a leader, the Spartak Moscow center back who missed the World Cup because of injury. He is the leader of this defensive lineup, and he should play a very, very major part in this tournament. This is his first major tournament. And Anton Shunil will likely play in goal, but he's the now Moscow goalkeeper. He's a nice goalkeeper, but he cannot be compared to Akinfeev by any means.
And we talk about these icons, these massive names associated with Russian football. But the player that you flagged up as the key to Russia and their chances in Euro 2020 is actually Brazilian-born Mario Fernandes, nationalised Russian international who plays his club football with CSKA Moscow. We saw him in the 2018 World Cup and he was relatively impressive, particularly from an attacking perspective. Given the way that Russia play, we know with Artem Dzyuba up front, they want to get crosses into the box to make use of the fact that he's very powerful and good in the air. Fernandes, despite the fact that he's a right back or a right wing back, is pretty central to Russia in the way that they play.
Absolutely. He is very, very important defensively, and he is very, very important offensively. He's the key player, and you could see during the World Cup, he was massive in defense, and he was massive in attack. He's a very disciplined player. He's very technically gifted player. In Brazil, when he started, he was seen as one of the rising at Grêmio, one of the best young Brazilian players at the time. About a decade ago, and he was called the new Lucio because he played in the central defense at the time. He was actually supposed to be the new Lucio for Brazil. Then he moved to right back, and he had some disciplinary problems in Brazil back then. But now he's a role model professional. He's really the best player Russia have at the moment. He's a Brazilian, so he doesn't speak Russian very well. So he can't be really the leader in the dressing room, but his spirit, his attitude, and his level of play, he's a model for other players, especially for young players. And you could see it 3 years ago during the World Cup. He's supposed to be absolutely crucial for Russia during this World Cup. And look, he is for Russia and for CSKA Moscow. He is basically what Trent Alexander-Arnold is for Liverpool. He's the playmaker and the leader and one of the most important figures tactically from a right back position.
And obviously, Dzyuba was central, not just in the 2018 World Cup, but in qualifying for Euro 2020. Three goals in the World Cup in 2018 and nine in qualifying to seal Russia's place in the tournament. But as you say, perceptions of him still persist as this big target man. Is he good enough at the highest level? And in 2018, he did prove some of the doubters wrong with the performances that he turned in. But does still seem to be a little bit of a nagging doubt over whether he's able to do it at the highest level. If Russia get out of the group and into the knockout stages, the likelihood is that they might need a goal or a strong performance from him. But given the fact that his record in qualifying was good, is that a little bit unfair? Because he's essentially proven himself deserving of a position as a starting striker.
Well, he now is the only good striker Russia have. And you see, we can speak for hours and hours about Dzyuba. He's an incredible character. He divides opinion, and he is important in the dressing room as he's a joker, and he has a very good sense of humor. On the other hand, a lot of people don't think he's really intelligent enough, even though some people think he is, just in his own way. He's not very serious, and he was involved in countless incidents on and off the field. He's a cult figure in Russia, and before the World Cup, people thought that he really is a village idiot. As simple as that. And during the World Cup, he was so good and so dedicated, and it became such a leader that he eventually became the hero and became the captain after Akinfeev and Ignashevich retired. So it's it's very difficult to predict what will happen with Zuba during this tournament. It can go either way. Whether he's good enough professionally, look, he's a very big target man. He is quite a visionary player. He provides a lot of assists. He sees the players around him. He tries to make use of them. He's not just, you know, in the old-fashioned center forward who wants to the balls crossed over to him and he's gonna have them on target. He's much more than that. He's very versatile for the Zenit. He proved himself during the national team against lesser opposition, but against top opposition, against Spain during the World Cup, he tends to fade away. Also, in the Champions League, Zenit didn't really achieve very good results, as we know. Zuba is one of the most experienced veteran player at the moment, but he's still he's still unpredictable, and you really don't know what to expect from him at this tournament. One thing is certain: he will make a lot of headlines with his game, with his quotes, with his behavior on the pitch, with his behavior off the pitch. His attitude and his his mood actually will be massively important for Russia during the European Championships.
So plenty of experience, plenty of characters, particularly with Zuba. But one player that's attracting some headlines is the teenager Arzen Zakarian, who plays his club football with Dynamo Moscow. And when you look through the Russian squad, there's a lot of people over 25 and quite a few over 30 in comparison to other squads. At 17, he gives a bit of youth and a bit of freshness to the team. He's not been capped at senior level, but he has been called up to the preliminary squad for the tournament. If Russian fans are looking at the team and who could potentially be an impact substitute or a bit of a wild card if they need a game changing moment or they need a goal in the closing stages, how highly rated is he? Could he give something that nobody else really in the Russia squad is capable of?
Well, one could hope that the answer is yes, because there are very few young players in this Russia team, and every team needs really a youngster who would be very, very positive and bring something youthful and energetic to the team. For example, at Euro 2012, Russia had Zagoev, who was the big white hope of the Russian football, and he actually performed very, very well during the tournament, even though Russia went out at the group stages. At the home World Cup, it was Golovin who was the big young hope of the Russian football, and he actually performed very, very well during that World Cup. He's still in the squad, but he's much older now, and he went through a lot of injuries, and he's quite inconsistent. And Monaco, one has to, he's still very important. But Russia needs someone younger, and there were no young players at all who received opportunities during the last 3 years. But now there is one, and Arsen Zakarian, who will celebrate his 18th birthday at the end of May. He has made a very, very positive impression in the Russian league for Dynamo Moscow. And he only, you know, he played just a few matches in the first division, but he's a magnificent young playmaker. His technical control is brilliant. His vision is brilliant. His decision making is absolutely amazing for such a young player, and people were really calling for him to get. They wanted Cherchesov to call him up into the squad. Very few believed that would happen, but it did happen. Zakarian is in the preliminary squad for Russia, and you never, it's impossible to predict whether he will, would actually make the final cut. But if he does, and if he gets some to play some games as a substitute, he could bring, he could really bring something very different. He is just a he brings the level of excitement that the young Michael Owen brought for England, the young Wayne Rooney brought for England. He is at that age and at that stage of his career when he and nobody outside of Russia knows anything about him. So he could actually be the mysterious player who nobody knows. And he just comes in and scores and assists, and you know, he could become a legend this summer.
Potentially, yeah.
Hopefully. Potentially.
Right. I'm going to call you for a prediction. The record of Russia post 1992 in international tournaments is not fantastic.
Oh, no.
Only two occurrences of getting out of the group stages. Obviously, one of them being 2018 in the World Cup in Russia. Given the fact that it's a difficult group, Belgium, who you know well from qualifying, are likely to be the strongest side in it. Where do you see Russia finishing? If you're looking at it from a positive perspective, you could see them getting out of the group, or do you think that's too much of a task?
Three teams can go out of the group, and 4 points would most likely be enough to go out of the group, whether you are second or third. And we have to see whether Teemu Pukki is fit for Finland, which is a huge, huge issue for the Finland team, and as a result for the Russian team. Obviously Russia can be favored to beat Finland at home. That should be within their grasp. And if they do it, and if they take a point or 3 points from Denmark and Belgium, well, then they are going to the next round. And with two home matches, that's what you would expect. I mean, to fail in this group and to finish last and not to go out of this group with two home matches would be seen as a massive, massive, massive failure. So I would predict that Russia make it to the next round. In the next round, it will be most likely a very difficult game. They are likely to go out at the last 16 stage.
Brilliant stuff. Very pragmatic, Michael. Thank you. And that brings to an end our Group B preview. Thanks so much for listening.